This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in what may be the largest human trafficking case in U.S. history, we'll talk about a lawsuit against Signal International.
500 Indian workers paid up to $20,000 to get jobs in the United States with promises of green cards. When they got here, those promises evaporated, but slave-like conditions didn't.
We'll talk with professor and author John Ehrenberg about where the last 3 years of the Obama administration had slid the country economically.
Not just the last 3 years. The inequality in this country is getting greater and greater, and it's been 30 or 40 years.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. So last week, Heidi, I'm on vacation, and I get an email that talks about Mamiya and an extraordinary victory. You know, I don't usually call people from my vacation, but I called you, Heidi, because I know how deeply involved you are with Mamiya's case and how you visited him and how you worked so hard on that case. So, Heidi, what is the incredible news about Mamiya?
Last week, Michael, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that imposition of the death penalty in Mumia's case is unconstitutional. What that means is that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania may either call for a new sentencing hearing nearly 30 years after the trial.
In which he could either get the death penalty or life sentence again.
Yes.
Or
Mumia will remain life in prison.
So it's extraordinary. They basically tossed the death penalty in the Third Circuit.
Exactly.
And the choice of the state now, as I recall, it said they have to hold a hearing on resentencing within 6 months or he automatically gets the life sentence.
Exactly. Now, it should be noted that right after this decision was made public, the district attorney announced their decision to appeal.
Appeal. Now, where they would appeal, most likely, we don't know where they'd go to. They can either go en banc, which means all the judges of the Third Circuit, or they can
which
try...
Which is highly unusual, we should note, but it is done, and it is done in political cases. We saw it in the case of the Cuban Five, after the very courageous three-judge panel there ruled that they had received an unfair trial.
Right, in which case it would go to a dozen or so judges in the Third Circuit, or they could decide to just bypass that and go right to the Supreme Court, which has already ruled in an analogous case. And, of course, the Third Circuit tried to distinguish Mamiya's case from that Supreme Court decision.
Which was called Spisak. This three-judge panel really distinguished Mumia's case from Spisak, which means that they compared them and they found that Mumia's was quite different all around the issue of the confusion on the juror form. And it had to do with whether the jury was unanimous in mitigating circumstances, which is not the rule in Pennsylvania, but the jury form led them to believe they had to be unanimous.
How many years has Mumia been on death row?
It's 29.
29 years. So this is extraordinary, this ruling.
This decision took 10 years to wind its way through the courts because the prosecutor has announced that they want to appeal this decision. They want to kill him. And the defense here is by no means over.
No, it isn't. But the state is getting a lot of setbacks now. I mean, this is a big one. Mamiya had won in the circuit. The Supreme Court's other case said, now you have to go look at it again. They looked at it again. My guess is because it's a factually oriented case having to do with Pennsylvania and Pennsylvania law, that they're not going to look at this again, even though I agree with you, Michael, that they want to kill this guy. For all of those people who have looked at this case, criticized Mamiya and all this kind of stuff, I mean, this is an extraordinary victory for Mamiya, for life, and a blow against the death penalty.
Michael, what's happening with WikiLeaks?
Well, I'm sure, as most of our listeners know, in the last week or so, an extraordinary flood of government documents has come out of WikiLeaks and other newspapers, which are the files, at least the level of secret files, on almost every one or many of the detainees at Guantanamo, some still there, some out. And their coverage has been very spotty in terms of who does what with them. So, for example, the New York Times did a bad story trying to say that these documents show that some of these people were highly dangerous. The Guardian did a much better story pointing out a couple of things. One key one is that the principal reason for Guantanamo was an interrogation camp, not a place to keep people who had committed crimes or were dangerous. And they know that because a lot of the people there were picked up and they were completely innocent. They were taken there because they supposedly had knowledge about Taliban or Al-Qaeda, or they were the imam at a mosque, and they might know something. And they picked those guys up, and they took them to Guantanamo, really solely for purpose of interrogation, which has been illegal forever. I mean, that stuff has been illegal in wars, in non-wars. It's illegal. The Geneva Conventions of 1949 were passed specifically because the Germans ran interrogation camps, and they're completely barred and outlawed. And yet the principal thing that comes out of these new WikiLeaks documents is that the U.S. was running Guantanamo as an interrogation camp, not as a camp for terrorists. That's one thing. The other thing that comes out is the evidence that was used is completely shaky, spotty, and unreliable.
The evidence to put them in there.
The evidence to put them in there and the evidence they got to keep them in there. So, for example, there's 235 people who the government claimed there was evidence that they were in some way involved with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or taken up arms against the United States. What these documents show is that all that evidence came from two detainees who were tortured against 235 people. So come on, it's completely made up, it's fictitious. And so the documents go a long way toward demonstrating what we have been saying all along. Guantanamo is an illegal, unconstitutional black hole of interrogation and torture.
And to give you an idea of the quality of the people they were picking up, one guy was in his late 80s and was suffering from dementia, and another young man was 14 years old. Even Jeffrey Miller, who's no great shakes, is a civil libertarian, the general that was in charge of the place, said this is outrageous, a 14-year-old.
Now, and what is Obama's position on all of this?
Well, the government issued its position being completely outraged that the documents got out. And what's interesting about that is that lawyers, some of them in my office who have security clearance, because their security clearance basically says they can only handle secret documents in a certain way, they're not supposed to even read these documents to work on their cases.
Even though it's up on the New York Times website, the lawyers can't
right.
read them.
It's quite extraordinary. And of course, it also is important to note that the documents you're going to be looking at when you go to the Times site or the Guardian site are all documents classified secret, not top secret. And what's interesting about that is the top secret documents are the ones where all the torture is put in and which WikiLeaks apparently did not get. And so those are still out there. So to complete this picture, you really need
The top secret
documents. And of course, the Obama administration is not only going after the people who allegedly leaked the secret documents, but is keeping to itself all of the torture documents, which of course brings us to the next wonderful little Obamaism.
Well, Bradley Manning is now sitting in Fort Leavenworth prison because they say he leaked documents to WikiLeaks, but they haven't been able to prove that yet. In any case, they've had him in prison now for, I think, 9 months under terrible conditions, initially in a Marine brig. Finally, after a lot of public pressure, they took him out of what was really torturous conditions and put him in Fort Leavenworth, which is no great place. Anyway, he's in Fort Leavenworth. A reporter asks Obama about his guilt, and Obama says, and they recorded this, and it's been viral on the net. Obama says, "This is a nation of laws." Thank you, Professor. He broke the law. Well, the problem with Obama saying he broke the law is that Obama is the commander-in-chief and that they're trying this guy under a military court. So all the people in his, quote, jury are going to be people serving under Obama. And if they want their career to go anywhere, they better vote the right way. So Obama made it completely impossible to have a fair trial for Bradley Manning.
It's a clearly unethical statement, actually. It should not have been said. It's prejudicial, and that alone should be able to get Bradley Manning out, that he can't have a fair trial. Good luck.
The Board of Governors of the Bar in Illinois should investigate him. We here at Law and Disorder would like to invite all of our listeners to come to the Len Wineglass Memorial, which will be at Ethical Culture Society of New York, located at 64th Street and Central Park West on May 13th, 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6. The Len Wineglass Memorial. Please come.
In what may be the largest human trafficking case in U.S. history, Indian guest workers are suing Signal International for human trafficking and racketeering. Several law firms filed the lawsuit on behalf of 7 plaintiffs, representing 500 former guest workers lured into the United States after Hurricane Katrina. The guest workers were subjected to racial discrimination, forced labor, and other abuse. Signal is a multi-million dollar marine fabrication company with shipyards in Mississippi, Texas, and Alabama. They repair and build oil rigs and ships and subcontract with the Department of Defense as well as with multinational companies. After Hurricane Katrina, Signal's workforce scattered, and they used the government's guest worker program to import employees as welders and pipe fitters. Between 2004 and 2006, hundreds of Indian men had to pay up to $20,000 each for travel, visa, and other fees after being told that it would lead to good jobs and permanent U.S. residency. When the men arrived at Signal, they discovered they would not even receive green cards, but instead were given 10-month guest worker visas. Signal forced the men to pay over $1,000 a month to live in overcrowded, unsanitary, and racially segregated labor camps with no visitors allowed. To talk more about this case, we're joined by Chandra Bhatnagar, staff attorney with the Human Rights Program. We're also joined by Sabalal Vijayan, a former guest worker involved in the lawsuit.
Chandra and Sabalal, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chandra, I know you're a lawyer at the ACLU, and you won an important phase of a case having to do with Indian guest workers working in the United States. You describe, what is that case about?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having us on the program, Michael. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, companies in the Gulf Coast, and particularly the company that is in question in this case, Signal International, used the opportunity for the storm to seek out new labor pools. And Signal, in partnership with an American labor broker, an American immigration lawyer, and an Indian recruiter, conspired to bring in a group of over 500 men from India as H-2B guest workers. And guest workers are temporary workers who, by the terms of their visa, are allowed to remain in the United States for 10 months. That visa can be renewed twice. So Signal attested to the U.S. government that it had a temporary short-term labor need, and thus the Department of Labor certified Signal to go bring in these workers from India. Now, simultaneous to this, the workers had been recruited with promises of green cards, promises of permanent residency, the opportunity for long-term jobs.
Let's slow down for 1 second.
Sure.
So we got the certification for the right to bring in temporary guest workers after Katrina. And then back in India, which is most of the workers are from India?
They're all from India. Some were recruited in India, and some were recruited in the Gulf, where they were also working.
So 500 of them.
That's right.
So back in India, there's a program for then recruiting the workers to fill the guest worker slots. And you are articulating really promises that were made to the workers in the recruitment process. So run through those promises.
Absolutely right. There were newspaper advertisements that were posted which offered opportunities for green card and permanent residency and bringing your family to the United States. There were a series of presentations in cities all over India, and as well as in the United Arab Emirates, which had PowerPoints, which again promised green card permanent residency. And the forms that the workers signed also promised green cards and permanent residency. And we found out during the course of discovery, actually, I took the deposition of the Indian recruiter, and he said that across the board, he had made promises of green cards to all the workers because that was his understanding of what Signal wanted him to do.
I want to bring Sabalal into the conversation for a minute right now. Sabalal, I guess you heard what Chandra said about the way in which the workers for Signal were recruited. What was the manner in which you were recruited?
I was working in the Middle East, United Arab Emirates. The recruiter for Signal International gave an ad in the newspaper saying that we will get permanent residency and green card in America, and they are recruiting ship fitters and welders to this country.
Now, Sabalal, did you have to pay money to come and work in this country?
Yeah, I paid about $18,000 for this job. And they offered me a green card and permanent residency. And they told me we need to pay this much of amount for them.
Now, did you ever, when you worked for Signal, did you ever get a green card?
No, never. They expelled me from the company after 2 months.
They tried
to send me back to India.
They expelled you back. That means you lost a lot of money. Is that right?
Yeah.
Why'd they expel you?
They packed us in a container with 24 other people. And I start to ask for my rights, because I heard that this country is giving more opportunities and liberty and justice to all. But the fact that in a container with 24 other people, I'm always saying like pigs in a cage.
I'm sorry, I want to be clear because the telephone connection is not perfect. You said you were in a container with 24 other people?
Well, the living condition inside the company.
It's a, like a temporary trailer.
Right. So you were in there with 24 other people.
Yeah.
And you started to complain about those conditions?
I complained about those conditions, and they discriminated as in the inside the company. Among the Americans, we were supposed to work hard other than the Americans, and they forced us to do the job.
And you were living in this trailer. How much rent were they charging you?
They were charging $1,050 a month from all of us.
Those are New York prices.
And you had paid already $18,000 to get there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
The EEOC last week, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, an arm of the U.S. government, anti-discrimination arm of the U.S. government, brought a separate lawsuit against Signal alleging racial and national origin discrimination, hostile work environment, and actually Sabalal is one of the people that was interviewed by the EEOC, and because he was one of the leaders of the workers who was seeking to assert his rights under the law, he was particularly targeted by Signal and was rounded up in an early morning raid, held in a room with guards, and then was about to be sent into a van to be sent back to India. And so there's a retaliation charge in the EEOC lawsuit as well, which is part of what he was referring to when he said that he was targeted because he was the lead organizer.
I know in your complaint you label this human trafficking, and I'd like you to expand on that term because it's really a shocking term. It sounds like, you know, slave labor.
Surely. The workers were promised, as we were discussing, green cards. They paid up to $20,000 each with expectations of green cards. They arrive in the United States. They find out these promises were completely fraudulent. And then they're living in these horrific conditions, as he described, 24 men in one trailer, horrible food. There was an internal email from Signal that said if the health department ever saw the cafeteria, they would shut this place down. The camp was built on a lead-contaminated waste site. A Signal executive in another internal email said that when being asked whether we should try to have fewer people in the bunkhouses, he said no, it would be too onerous to comply with the requirements of OSHA. So the workers,
OSHA is the
Occupational Safety Health Act. So these are federal laws which require, you know, because it's not OSHA compliant to have 24 guys jammed together in a temporary trailer. So these guys were here, and then as they were in the United States and they're in debt, the average income is about $3,000 a year in India for a ship worker, for a fitter or a welder. And to be able to pay, you know, $18,000 to $20,000, you have to sell your property. You have to borrow money from loan sharks and money lenders.
6 years of their income.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Without any expenses.
Without any expenses. So you have to really mortgage your whole life for the opportunity to come here. So then when they come here, they're completely powerless because Signal holds their H-2B, you know, they're the sponsor for the H-2B visa. So they are basically the disposable property of Signal. And Signal says, any of you that make trouble, any of you that try to create problems or complain about the conditions, we'll send you back. And if any of you file a lawsuit, we'll send all of you back. We found this out during the course of discovery as well. So the threats that Signal made, knowing the debt that they had, knowing the amount of kind of suffering that would incur to them if they were sent back to India, because, you know, if you owe that much money to loan sharks and money lenders, you know, bad things can happen to you if you go back to India in that amount of debt, and there's a real threat of violence.
Let me get a little bit of an overall picture, Chandra. There were 500 workers working for Signal and other affiliated corporations doing pipe fitting, welding, things like that. Can you give us a picture of where it was when you began the lawsuit and where it is now?
Sure. So Signal hired an American labor broker, an Indian recruiter, and an American immigration lawyer. Those people provided this group of workers who worked at Signal. They worked at two shipyards. One was in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and one was in Orange, Texas. And they were functionally the same layout. The workers were sent to either of these camps without any choice as to where they were being sent. But the workers came in waves. So Signal's claim that, oh, we didn't know they were promised green cards, at the very latest, the first group of workers, the first, you know, 25, 50 guys who arrived.
You filed a class action, right?
We filed a class action against Signal, against the American immigration lawyer, Malvern Burnett, the American labor broker, Michael Pohl, the Indian recruiter, Sachin Dhawan, and other related parties. And we alleged violations of the Trafficking Victim Protection Act, RICO, Civil RICO, which is the Racketeering-Inspired Corrupt Organizations Act, as well as discrimination claims, under the 1981, 1985, which are civil rights statutes, in addition to breach of contract, fraud, a number of other claims as well. As you can see, this enterprise, this was a conspiracy really between the Indian recruiter, the immigration lawyer, the labor broker, and Signal, all of whom conspired together. The recruiter and the immigration lawyer and the labor broker were managed to get, up to $20,000 each from these workers, so they got rich, and Signal got this free, completely vulnerable pool of workers who they could use and throw away whenever they wanted to.
What's happening right now at Signal? I mean, are there still all the workers? How many have there been retaliation? There clearly was against Sabulal on the phone with us. Others, I mean, is this still going on?
Almost all the workers have left at this point. We filed the lawsuit in 2008 in March, and there was a big Sabulal was discharged in 2007. He can tell you more about that. But we filed the lawsuit in March of 2008, and a few days before we filed, there was a group of workers who all had a walkout together, a big, huge group of workers who joined arms, walked outside of the gates of Signal, took off their hard hats, and threw them against the fence. And I should mention, the team that's litigating this case in partnership with the workers, Southern Poverty Law Center is the lead counsel. The law firm of Dewey and LaBeouf are also joint lead counsel, Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, ACLU, as well as Louisiana Justice Institute.
Chandra, what kind of relief are you asking for, and what do you expect?
What we expect is we're in the phase of we just had the class certification phase of the case. So we've filed a renewed motion for class certification. We're asking the court to certify these seven putative class members as representatives of a class and to grant us class status. And then moving forward, we'll be proceeding on to merits discovery. So we're hoping that the workers will be appropriately compensated for the real abuse that they've suffered.
Sabulal, you're still with us, aren't you? But I'm interested in what kind of work you did at Signal and the circumstances of how you got fired.
I was working as a pipe fitter in Signal International. I tried to ask for my rights when they packed me in this temporary trailer with 24 other people. I asked them that we need better living conditions and we need better work environment. And then they told me that this is not your India, this is America. If you want to stay in this country, you must keep quiet, shut up, and sit down. That was the answer from Signal International. I tried to get my rights in the United States, and I organized my people because they reduced our wages from $18 to $13 after a month.
You were making $18 an hour, right?
Yeah, I was getting $18 an hour, but they reduced the wages to $13 for a few people. Then we start to organize to ask for our rights. They send armed guards in the early morning, and they catch me from the breakfast line, and they try to send me, to deport me and some of my friends to India because of this organizing.
And how did they do that? I mean, did they actually grab you physically? What did they do?
They send armed guards to the man camp at the early morning at 5 o'clock, and the manager told me, you are under my custody, and we are going to send you back to India. And I asked him why, and he said nothing. There was nothing left over here, and I found the circumstances is bad, and there were armed guards there, and I was in fear, and I cut my wrist in fear to kill myself because I spent this much of dollar, whatever I earned in India, and I was in the hospital for 3 days because of I slit my wrist.
How did you get away? How did you get out of custody?
By virtue of by his suicide attempt.
I see you cut your wrists. That meant you had to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Then you were no longer in custody, and you weren't, and you prevented yourself from being deported. Is that it?
Yes. Because I spent all the money for this job, and they promised me a green card and permanent residency, so I couldn't go back to India with bare hands to my family because I spent all the money for this job. Not only me. The 500 Indian workers spent all their money, they sold their ornaments, they sold their land and houses for this job. And the company cheated us and they were trying to deport us because of asking for our rights.
I think one of the significant points of this case is the one that one of your lawyers, Chandra, mentioned, was that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has now stepped into the case. making this, I guess, the biggest trafficking case ever in the United States. Is that right, Chandra?
If the class is certified, it could potentially be the largest labor trafficking case in U.S. history. And, as Sabalal mentioned, the retaliation that he faced because of his organizing activities really cannot be – the importance of that cannot be understated. Signal really was trying to send a message to all the workers by virtue of what they did to him. And had it not been for his suicide attempt – his suicide attempt resulted in him going to the hospital. The media got wind of the story. The police came. It became a huge kind of an event. And the workers, began working with local immigrant rights advocates in Mississippi, the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, and then working with the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice. And so there was a lot of organizing that happened with the workers that resulted in the workers kind of building power. And then as, we filed the lawsuit, the workers had engaged in a satyagraha, which is a truth march from Mississippi all the way to Washington, D.C. They took buses and they marched. And then there were activities in Washington. There was a hunger strike that they had outside the Department of Justice. There was a number of organizing activities that the workers did to really put their story out there. They continue to kind of, Sabalal continues to lead organizing amongst the workers even now.
It's an amazing story because each individual is subject to the complete control of the company, their visas, their passports, everything, their job. I mean,
their passports, they had possession of their immigration documents, which is what enabled, workers over time to leave the company. But the fact that you don't have freedom of contract as a guest worker, you're essentially the disposable property of the employer.
If your job is over, your status is over.
Right. So you're tied to the company who brings you in.
But it's even worse because by bilking these guys out of their life savings to come here and then by paying them even less than they promised to pay them, $13 an hour amounts to, in a good year, $26,000, and you've stolen $20,000 from them just to bring them here. So I understand what you mean when you say trafficking and slavery. That's precisely what they did to victimize these people.
One question, Chandra, is this is one company, Signal. It's a big, big number of people who are subjected to trafficking and discrimination. But it does seem to me that on these kind of visas, a lot more people in this country are subject to this kind of abuse. I mean, it seems obvious to me. If you're at the behest of a company, they can do almost anything.
That's absolutely correct. And that's part of the reason why I think the workers felt it was so important to organize, because they realized that what was happening to them was happening to workers all over, and that companies were able to take this. I'll share an anecdote. We did an event with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, who are an amazing entity. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with them. And I had a conversation with one of their organizers who was a former tomato picker. She's a woman from Mexico. She'd come over as a guest worker, and she was had described a meeting she had with the grower of the tomato plant or tomato farm that she used to work on. And she described him as this like stereotypical kind of redneck southern man with a big white hat who was fanning himself. And she said that he said, "I know why you all," meaning the workers, "are upset about the guest worker program. The guest worker program is the greatest thing in the world for the owners and the growers." He goes, "We used to have to buy our slaves, but now we can rent them."
That's an amazing note. Sabalal, is there anything else you want to tell our listeners about your situation, about this struggle? I mean, it does sound remarkable that you were able to organize.
The guest worker program actually brings the employees from outside the country, outside the United States, and lock them in a horrible situation like this, because we don't have enough power to control anything over here, and the people are not aware of the laws and their rights in this country, and the employers are taking advantage of this cheap labor system. So we don't want such kind of visa system anymore, because when we hired, there was only 6 months left and false promises. We were not aware of will we get a green card or will this H-2B visa needs us to a certain residency. We were totally blind. And the company took all the advantage of this, and about 500 families and the dependents, including about 5,000 people who were in trouble, who was from India. But we need to change the system to benefit the employees who are coming to this country with a lot of hope, and they don't want to be get treated like this by Signal International. So we need to make awareness in this level system and educate the people, and don't put the poor people in some other country like in trouble like this.
Thank you very much. We want you to come back on the show with Chandra when you win this suit so we can announce it to all our listeners. Good luck to you. You have our solidarity.
Thank you, Sabalal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chandra.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Returning guest, professor and author John Ehrenberg, joins us in the discussion of where the Obama administration has gone in the last 2 years. The United States is pouring trillions of dollars into multiple war theaters. Unemployment continues very high. CEOs of banks and corporations have been rewarded with bonuses and bailouts. And there is an increasing, massive, unequal distribution of wealth in our country. Meanwhile, organized labor is under increasing attack. Corporations and the far right wing of the Republican Party are behind much of this union busting. Yet President Obama has turned his back when asked to support the unions. We discuss these issues and more with Professor Ehrenberg. He's the author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice, and a professor of political science at Long Island University.
John, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here.
John, there hasn't been such inequality in this country since, I think, all the way back to the 20s. It's just extraordinary how much money is filtered up from the bottom to the top. We wanted to ask you, what's the mechanism for this phenomena? What's behind all of this?
It depends on who you listen to. The usual explanation that you find in the mainstream media is that it's a combination of globalization, the so-called value-added stuff that comes with higher education, the general premium paid to higher paid skills in the workforce. I don't think it's any of those. I mean, I think those play a role, but the elephant in the room that nobody talks about is the role of the state and the role of the government, pursuing a policy of 30 years standing now since Reagan.
Can you first, before we go into why it happened, can you give us some of the overall numbers on the inequality in the United States?
Oh, yeah. Got them right here. Now, there's a really good book, which I would urge your listeners to take a look at, by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. One is a political scientist. The other is an economist. It's called Winner Take All Politics. It just came out last year, and it's really quite a good book on the extent of the problem and, above all, on the role of government and government policy in creating and exacerbating the problem. But let me give you some numbers. This is quoting from them. This is a mammoth and monumental sea change from the earlier period that Paul Krugman calls the period of the Great Compression.
Period of what?
He calls it the Great Compression.
Compression.
Yeah. And what he means by that is that from the end of World War II until roughly the economic crisis of the late 60s and early 70s, whether you were a Democratic president or Republican president, the policy of the state was a modest Keynesianism of stimulus when recessions hit and of letting things go when the economy was going ahead. A mildly interventionist and mildly regulatory apparatus, and above all, a fiscal policy which tended to toward the demand side of stimulating consumption on the part of the middle and working classes. And this was the common wisdom and a bipartisan consensus. So Nixon could say, and rightly so, we are all Keynesians now. That was the consensus for about 40 years of American economic history, and it became gradually undone and was officially consigned to the dustbin of history by Ronald Reagan in 1980 when he announced a full-blown assault on the previous regime. What you had since 1980 is a policy which has been pushed by the Republicans but acquiesced in by the Democrats of undoing the Great Society and of undoing the great consensus that underlay much of the New Deal as well. This is something that's been happening and with more and more ferocity. I mean, we can see it in the union busting. We can see it in the refusal to even contemplate taxing the rich. But it's been happening because the Republican Party has been getting more and more radical and more right-wing. And as the Republican Party gets more and more radically right-wing, it pulls the Democratic Party with it. So let me give you some numbers. The villain in the room, like I say, is governmental, monetary, and fiscal policy, which is what people don't really understand. And when they're told about it, I'll give you some information from social science about this. But let me give you some statistics. And this is quoting from Pearson and Hacker's book. Astonishing statistics, they say. From 1979, which is when this whole Keynesian consensus began to come under sustained assault, until the eve of the Great Recession, so this is 3-4 years ago, the top 1% received 36% of all gains in household income, even after taking into account the value of employer-sponsored health insurance, all federal taxes, and all government benefits. So let me repeat that. The top 1% of the population received more than a third of all the wealth created in the country from 1979 until the beginning of the recession.
What was it like during the prior period?
It was much, I don't have the numbers, but it was much better. It was more like 21%. And in some cases, in the mid-1950s, it was as low as 12%. That's when the marginal tax rates on high incomes was 91%. Here's some more. Economic growth, this is, again, quoting from the book. Economic growth was more skewed between 2001 and 2006, during which the share of income gains going to the top 1% was over 53%. So it's getting worse. More than 50 cents of every dollar in additional income pocketed by Americans over this last half decade went to the richest one in 100 households.
1%.
1%.
So of every dollar made, 50%.
More than 50 cents. Now, it's worse. The top one-tenth of 1%, right? The top one-tenth of 1%, that's one out of every 1,000 households, received over 20% of all the after-tax income gains between 1979 and 2005, compared with 13.5% enjoyed by the bottom 60%. Here's the staggering way to think about this. If total economic growth of those years was a pie, the slice enjoyed by the 300,000 people in the top one-tenth of 1% of the population would be half again as large as that enjoyed by the bottom 180 million.
The pie was how many people?
You said the total economic growth of those years was a pie, the slice enjoyed by the roughly 300,000 people in the top one-tenth of 1% of the population would be half again as large as the slice enjoyed by the 180 million people in the bottom 60%.
It's half
again,
the pie.
One and a half times.
One and a half. Oh.
One and a half.
Oh.
Half again.
That's what I was
one
asking
and,
because I knew I had some numerically challenged people here, including myself.
So not only, so the takeaway is that not only has it been getting, it's been getting more and more radically skewed, the real thing to examine is the role of the government.
So the question, I won't ask you why there hasn't been a revolution, but tell us what caused this.
It was a conscious policy. It began as an offensive by business in the late 1970s, late 1960s and early 70s, against what they thought was the overregulation and overburdened tax system. If you look at some of the neoconservatives from that period, their target is the Great Society. They claim they had no issue with the New Deal. It was the Great Society. And in particular, it was Medicaid, Medicare, and some of the set-asides that the Great Society organized. By the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Carter stagflation had created a situation from which there seemed to be no escape. I mean, the details are laid out there in histories of the period. But basically what happened in the late 60s and early 70s is that the traditional stimulus programs of the Democrats failed to get the country out of this. For those of your listeners who remember back then, what you had was a combination, an unheard of combination before then, of economic stagnation and very, very high inflation, which usually didn't go together. What that meant was that the traditional Democratic policy of stimulus in times of recession didn't work because there was high inflation, and that was ruled out. At the same time, the tight monetary policy, which was also a possibility to cool down inflation, didn't work because there was high unemployment. So the result was a trap for traditional Democratic Party politics, and they couldn't figure out a way. Along comes Reagan. He beats Carter in the election, along comes Reagan, and he undertakes this radical restructuring of the American economy with trickle-down economics and so-called Reaganomics, which begins this process of shoveling huge amounts of money toward the rich in the hope that it would trickle, like you guys say, it would trickle down and you would have sustained growth. It didn't happen that way.
Well, they didn't really expect it to trickle down and have sustained growth.
That was for public consumption that would trickle down. That's what allowed him to get away with it.
Let me ask a question about Obama, because you were on the show a year and a half ago or so, you know, you had your choices, and you felt Obama would be more of a Keynesian and a little bit more of the traditional Democrat, and that would at least give us a bit more of our social safety net. As I asked you when you came in, how's that hopey change you think doing?
Consider that Obama intends to raise $1 billion for his reelection campaign. Where is he going to get it from?
Corporations.
And the rich.
Hedge funds.
Yeah. And look, he claims he's laid down a marker and he's not going to accept a further extension of the Bush tax cuts and blah, 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 blah. Look, anybody at this stage of the game who continues to trust the Democratic Party to lead the country out of this mess is a fool.
So the thing again
is a fool. And it's been, you know, it's always been the case that the Democratic Party, when it responds to pressures brought upon it from outside. There's this famous story. I don't know if it's true or not. There's this famous story about FDR. When he was first president, speaking to a bunch of trade unionists who came into his office and was demanding that he do this and demanding that he do that. And FDR was saying, I can't. Make me. Let's make him if he is to be made. And the only, you know, Fran Piven's always been right about this. The Democratic Party by itself is incapable of democratic initiative and progressive change unless forced to respond to pressures from outside.
Talk to us about what is quite evident, extreme escalation of the rich is personified by the Koch brothers, not only on the standard of living, but on the democratic rights of working people.
You know, it's amazing. I taught this course on Marx last semester, and we read Capital. I had the students, it was a graduate seminar, and they read the first volume of Capital. And one of the questions that Marx asks in the very beginning of the book is a question that you just asked, Michael. When is it enough?
Yeah.
When do they have enough? And the answer in 1,100 pages of wonderful analysis is that it never is enough. That the logic of Capital is to reduce everybody to starvation and take everything they have.
This is not an ethical thing. This is the
motor of the system.
Yes.
This is the way the system works. It has nothing to do with the Koch brothers or this guy or that guy or Eric Cantor or anything. That unless they're stopped, they will take everything you've got.
But now we see a little bit of resistance. Maybe the people have had enough. We saw that, I don't want to say a little bit. We saw it in Wisconsin, obviously, with the protests against destructive of bargaining rights for the unions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading the paper the last couple of days, and some of the Republicans are having trouble, particularly on the Medicare issue, that their constituents are saying, what are you talking about, privatizing Medicare? And so there seems to be, I mean, are you feeling any of that going on, or is it hopeful? Or
yeah, I'd like to, you know. we all would like to, right? And hopefully people aren't tired of being pushed around. There's a report yesterday that some of these guys in Fort Lauderdale, there was almost a riot with people who were screaming and yelling about Medicare and linking it to the tax cuts for the rich, which is the nice linkage to be made. So look, this stuff is out there. Everybody knows what's going on. It's interesting about Americans and inequality because social scientists say that the United States is the great outlier among all the advanced industrialized countries in the weakness and the thinness of our safety net compared with all the other OECD countries in Western Europe. There were a couple of very interesting recent articles written in professional social science journals about the nature of income inequality and maldistribution and Americans' responses to it. It started off with a poll where Americans were asked what they thought the existing distribution of wealth in the country was. Almost universally, they didn't understand how bad it was, right? They think it's better than it is. So that was the first finding. The second finding was that when they were told how bad it was, they got really mad and they wanted a change and they wanted the government to lead a change and to undertake action to redistribute wealth. The third finding was that when they were asked what would be their ideal national distribution of wealth, they came up with numbers that were almost identical to the numbers in the Western European social democracies.
What are those numbers like?
I don't know. I should have brought them with me, but they're available.
Roughly, you know them roughly.
Yeah, it's a lot better than what we have now. So here's the dilemma. If you have a situation where Americans are misinformed about the distribution of wealth and are open to appeals to redistribute wealth in the name of fairness and equity, this would seem to be an ideal moment for a redistributive Democratic Party to step forward as the party of social justice and economic equality. We claim in social science that political parties respond to opportunities. This would seem to be a perfect opportunity for the Democratic Party, the party of the New Deal, the party of the welfare state, the party of the Great Society, to step forward and say, here's the real situation. Here's the real distribution of wealth in this country. Here's really why it happened, and rally the population to a broad campaign of economic redistribution. Why hasn't it?
Well, John Ehrenberg, let me venture a guess as to why this hasn't happened. And that's because the Democratic Party doesn't represent anything but a class. Political parties represent classes. In our country, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party represent essentially the same class. There's different coloration on it with the Democrats, but they're really responding to the same pressures. And I think the point about fundraising is really the important one. Even though people thought that Obama was raising a lot of money, you know, on Move On and from the bottom up. And he did raise some money there. Mm-hmm. But the big bucks came from Greenwich, Connecticut, came from the hedge funds, it came from Wall Street, came from the law firms in Washington. They're the ones who vetted him. They're the ones that sponsored him and supported him. And he's going back to them.
Yeah.
And that's why parties represent classes. And the Democratic Party, when push comes to shove, represents those very wealthy ruling classes.
I'm not sure you completely agree with Michael on that about the Democratic Party, John.
Well, I think it's true. But I think it's the differences between the two parties are also of some interest and of some importance to the current situation. Kevin Phillips agrees with, and I think Kevin Phillips is right as well. Kevin Phillips called the Democratic Party the second most enthusiastic capitalist party in the world.
And Kevin Phillips, I should add, was Reagan's speechwriter, who's had some revelations lately.
He has become a populist. He's become, yeah. And his stuff is terrific now. So,
he said his formulation was, he said the Democratic Party was the capitalist's second favorite party.
The capitalist's second favorite party. Okay, that's good. That's even better. On the other hand, the Democratic Party is the party of the state. It is the party of regulation. It is the party of the New Deal and the Great Society. And for example, the attacks on the trade unions coming out of Wisconsin and other states are clearly attacks on the Democratic Party, and they understand it. So absent a third party and absent any real short-term possibility of building a third party for all kinds of structural and other reasons, we're stuck with the Democratic Party. That doesn't mean that we need to trust them. If the Democratic Party is the only vehicle for even a modicum of sanity in American politics, it's because it's going to have to be pushed again, pushed and pushed and pushed from outside. I agree with you, Michael. It's right. It's a bourgeois party. But Marx always used to talk about the class struggle as being a struggle of two armies that are facing each other, each of which is fighting a civil war in its own ranks.
Michael mentioned something about Obama getting all this hedge fund money in the 2008 election in particular. You know, I guess they just had it with Bush. He was just too harsh. It was a steel glove, not a velvet glove, et cetera, all the analogies we can make. But I saw an article the other day that had a graph of the hedge fund contributions going into the next election. Extraordinary shift. The Republican hedge fund people across the board are supporting the Republicans right now.
Yeah.
Across the board, the hedge fund people are not supporting Obama. Yeah. And they claim it's because he's not supportive enough of Wall Street. He makes noises about Wall Street. What is that saying? Because Obama has been, as you and I and we all acknowledge, has really been unfortunately part of the problem, yeah, and not the solution.
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen between now and, I mean, Wall Street tends to be cautious in these kinds of things. They go with what they think is the winning hand, but they can shift their allegiances at any one moment. A lot depends on who the Republicans end up. Look, if they end up nominating Donald Trump or Michelle Bachmann, you're going to see a shift the other way. So this is all very, very early, and I don't think at the moment says anything in particular about the elections. What's really interesting is that there was a poll that came out last week about popular opinion with regard to extending the Bush tax cuts for the rich.
I saw that. Now, I know in the last couple of shows we've had you on, you've talked a lot about labor, and of course I remember your optimism about hopefully getting a checkoff for organizing a union, which of course Obama immediately let go of. But I'm interested in your take on Wisconsin, because there you had a huge outpouring in support of labor. And I'm interested in why it hasn't gone farther than it even did. What were the forces at play? How are we going to move that to the next stage? It seemed to me that the referendums they're having in Wisconsin, while interesting, were not really the logical next stage that could have actually made the change. A general strike would have been more like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just interested in your perceptions on that.
See, this is where the apostasy of the Democratic Party becomes most important, because, you know, there are local manifestations of outrage and rebellion in Wisconsin, even in Indiana, down in Fort Lauderdale, around different aspects of the maldistribution of wealth. But nothing's been coordinated on the national level. People are talking about what Governor Walker did, or people are talking about what this Republican representative in Congress was saying last week when he was down in Fort Lauderdale. But there are as yet no forces that are out there that are talking about the system as a whole, about the state and the state apparatus. This is why this question that Michael raised before about the need for an organized political presence, a class-based party that can articulate these issues, is so enormously important, and why its absence is so crippling to progressive reform or even socialist movements in this country. Absent that, there's this manifestation of revolt and that manifestation of revolt. Even the Fran Piven controversy. There was a moment when a lot of people, including all of us sitting around these microphones, decided they'd had enough. Now, clearly that's what was going on in Wisconsin. That's what's going on in Fort Lauderdale. There are indications across the board that a lot of people have had enough. What we're lacking is the broad comprehensive understanding.
We're lacking that, and I don't know if I'm right about this, but as soon as the massive demonstrations, the outrage, was put into the form by the Democrats of a referendum, it basically took the air out of what was going on in Wisconsin. So when you say what we have is the Democratic Party, I would say, yeah, we have the Democratic Party, but the way to push them is not to work with them.
Absolutely.
It's essentially to work against them.
Absolutely, from the outside. Push and push.
Because in my view, in Wisconsin, they didn't have the structure to be able to do what really needed to be done. And therefore, the Democrats come along and say, why don't we just throw these guys out in a referendum? And then it gets channeled into, quote, civilized discourse
That's what they do. The only solution, you're right. Look, that's all we got. To push and push and push from the outside. Build the movements. People go out there and join something and get involved. It's in the absence. We can sit here all day long and talk about the absence of a party, the absence of a comprehensive political ideology, but that's all true. If anything is going to come out of this situation, it's going to come out of people in the streets. You got to give it to the Tea Party people. They did what you have to do. They went out, they organized, they raised hell, and they've had a tremendous impact because of that. That's what we need to do, and we need to do it now. Let me give you some more statistics, and your listeners can find this online. This is a report from UNICEF called The Children Left Behind. The subtitle is A League Table of Inequality in Child Well-Being in the World's Rich Countries. It came out in November of last year. And it's going to be the foundation for next year. The UN is going to declare next year to be the Year of the Child. This is online. It can be downloaded as a PDF. Once again, a publication by UNICEF called The Children Left Behind. It's a chart of the 24 richest countries in the world, the OECD countries. It's basic countries of Europe, Australia.
What does OECD stand for?
Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's the organization of the world's rich countries. This is talking about a United States led by two parties professing their commitment and fidelity to family values. For all 24 of the countries, the overall record of child welfare. And there are lots of metrics. Your listeners can take a look at it. There are lots of metrics they develop to measure economic inequality, to measure material well-being, education well-being, and health well-being. Those are the three indices they use to chart out where countries stand on this question of where children are. Health, education, and material well-being. The United States is last.
Of the 24 countries?
Last of the 24. Last of all of them. On each of these three separate indices, of material well-being, education, and health, let me read it to you. And material well-being in the United States is 23 out of 24.
What does material well-being mean?
Material resources available to families. On education, the United States has this education system that is supposed to be the envy of the world. The United States is 19th out of 24. And on health, the United States is 22nd. Out of 24. This in the country of family values. This ought to spark a revolution. People ought to be in the streets about this kind of thing. But again, a lot of it is that people don't understand how bad the situation is. And they don't understand how bad the situation is because people out there aren't telling them.
They're also told that it's their fault.
But there's no...
It's an ideology in the country.
But Michael, when people are told what the real story is, they get really ticked off. And then their politics fall into line. The first step in letting people know how bad the situation is just giving them these numbers. And once you do that, then the road is open to a discussion of what to do.
John, who's top on that list in those categories?
Number one.
Where do we want to move?
Yeah, we want to. It's Denmark. The top four overall are the more advanced social democracies of Europe. So you've got Denmark first, Finland second, the Netherlands third, and Switzerland is fourth. When it comes to health, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Germany, and Switzerland, you know, the usual suspects. Yeah. You know, we're dead last.
We were almost dead first after the Second World War.
That's right.
Most of their economies had been destroyed.
That's right.
So even if we weren't doing that well, we were doing better. When I was a kid.
But you know what the difference is, Michael? Those countries, like, say, Switzerland or Portugal, don't have 750 bases in 130 countries around the world. They're not fighting three or four wars simultaneously. They're not paying benefits to veterans that go back 50 years. I think out of our $3 trillion budget, $1.4 trillion goes for past and present wars.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. I mean, you don't have bridges falling down in Denmark like you do here. The resources that we could use for decent things are all siphoned away in this country.
Yeah.
Any hope, or are we just a declining empire that's going to see the income disparities grow, the military grow, more wars? As we put more and more money, it's the Paul Kennedy theory, right?
Yeah, it's the Paul Kennedy thesis. That's right.
We put more into unproductive
military. Imperial overreach.
Keeping the world together on our terms that we go down.
If you look at the fall of many of the world's empires, it was a combination of overreach and the refusal of the rich to pay their share of taxes. You look at the commentaries around the fall of Rome, this was a constant. The rich simply saying, we're not going to do this. We're not paying. Go to hell. And the rich simply walking away from the whole situation. And then the society going down the tubes. So there's a lot of that going on now. But again, there's another tradition in this country. I mean, there really is, you know, lest we write the American people off as hopelessly backward, hopelessly misinformed, hopelessly greedy and selfish, there really is another really noble tradition in this country. You know, Reagan claimed that Reaganism represented the authentic American values. Sarah Palin has taken that line up, that, you know, it's the America of small towns and of farmers and of the brave yeomen of the Jeffersonian tradition. There are several traditions in this country. And like Michael said, classes produce their own history. Classes produce their own outlook. There's not one single American way of life or American way of doing things. There is a tradition in this country of economic justice. There is a tradition of redistribution. There is a tradition of soaking the rich when you need to. And that's the tradition to which we need to appeal. And once again, I am a pessimist in the long run, but there are these moments
you
when you look around. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I like Gramsci's formulation, John. Pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the heart. And I think about those 2,000 tractors in a snowstorm driving down the highways towards Madison, Wisconsin last winter. That's where it's at. That's what we have to emulate.
We've been speaking with Professor John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. John, thank you very much.
A pleasure,
thanks,
guys.
Thanks, John.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.